Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time Wicked Witch wannabe.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that wants to think that anxiety over life choices is something that should be confined to the world of cinema. And while clearly that isn't the case, we do prefer to talk about such issues as they play out on screens big and small, rather than have to face them for real. Which brings us to the two films that we'll be discussing for this week's show. The first is part one of John M. Chu's planned two-part adaptation of the popular Broadway musical Wicked. The second is Clint Eastwood's latest drama, Juror No. 2, this one starring Nicholas Hoult. Let's begin with a trek to the land first dreamed up by the writer L. Frank Baum in his novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, but then reimagined 95 years later in Gregory Maguire's novel Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West. It's in the land of yellow brick roads where Elphaba, played by Cynthia Erivo, lives. Rejected by her father and treated by pretty much everyone else as an outcast, Elphaba, soon dubbed Elfie, is tasked by Dad to accompany and protect her younger sister as she enters university. Almost immediately, however, Elfie is noticed by the university's Dean of Sorcery, played by Michelle Yao, because of her telekinetic powers, and is taken on as the dean's pet student. All this is narrated in a story told years later by another student, Glinda, later just Glinda, played by Ariana Grande. Anyone familiar with The Wizard of Oz will recognize her as Glinda the Good, and it is she who recalls the past friendship that she had with Elfie, how they began as rivals and ended up besties, even, not to give away too many spoilers, but when Elfie's dreams of meeting up with Oz's Grand Wizard, played by Jeff Goldblum, go awry and cause her to alter her life's direction. Director Chu, best known for 2018's rom-com Crazy Rich Asians, handles the musical numbers as well as he did in his 2021 adaptation of the Lin-Manuel Miranda musical In the Heights, even if they often get mired in a too amped-up style of frenetic energy. The production values themselves should earn a few Oscar nominations, yet the stars of the show are Erivo and Grande, the latter likely earning her own Oscar nomination not just for her acting, but also her singing and, at times, gymnastic dancing. Too bad we'll have to wait for what looks to be a full year for part two.
Well, this is one of those times where the hype for a cultural property has just totally eluded me. I know that this show has been around for two decades now, I think is when it came out in 2003 or 2004. And I've never seen it, despite the many years where I was actually reviewing theater productions. I never managed to see Wicked. I haven't read the books or the main book that Gregory Maguire wrote about this. And I only knew a couple of the songs just from, you know, being alive in the world and occasionally hearing Defying Gravity or Popular or something like that. And I know, personally know, a lot of theater fanatics who love this story and already love this particular big screen adaptation of Wicked. But I went into this movie with no existing nostalgia for or existing goodwill toward Wicked. And as I was watching this 2-hour, 40-minute first half of a saga movie, I just came to the conclusion that it's just not for me. I didn't really find this to be the kind of soaring transportive work that a lot of people that love this story have found it to be. And I think it's probably a me problem and not the movie's problem, because so many people are loving this movie and I just felt nothing towards it, I'm sorry to report. So take everything I say with a grain of salt or choose to just disregard it completely. I don't think I am the right person to be reviewing this film anyway. But, you know, I do love big screen musicals, and I love when, even when I don't particularly like, becomes a hit with the public, because Hollywood loves to talk about the fact that the musical is dead. The big screen musical isn't bankable anymore. And yet there have been so many examples over the years that prove that absolutely wrong. And this movie's already a behemoth, and it's a movie with, you know, big singing and dancing musical numbers in them. So at some point, Hollywood is going to have to come to terms with the fact that this is a genre that people will show up for. And I'd like to see more original musicals on the big screen, like a La La Land, for instance. Those really don't come about very often. But I've seen interviews with John M. Chu where he, and by the way, the marketing train on this film has been just chugging along.
Yeah.
Oh my God, the amount of money they must have spent on all of the marketing for Wicked.
Tie-in marketing.
But I've seen John M. Chu talking about, you know, oh, we built all these huge sets, these real sets that the actors were in. And I think that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the movie still kind of has this digital sheen to it where I didn't really feel that tactility. I didn't feel like the characters were really occupying real places or real sets. And I think that I actually kind of thought it was visually dreary in a lot of places. I should have a caveat here that I saw this with really lousy projection at the AMC, and it was dark and dingy a lot of the time. So I do think, you know, maybe I should give it another shot and see it.
And that's because you weren't able to get tickets to the Dolby show.
Yeah, it was sold out, so I saw it in regular projection, and I regret it, honestly. But I also think it's just more indicative of how movies are made now than it is about Wicked itself. But I will end here with a positive, because I agree with you that the two central performances are really good. And when the movie does work, it's because of them. It's because they're singing their hearts out. And they're those singers, Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo, are those kinds of singers that these songs are really hard to sing.
Yeah.
And they make it look effortless. Like, there is no effort happening here, even though I know there is a lot. They just have that way of performing where it just seems like, you know, singing these songs is as easy for them as just speaking their lines. So I thought they were really good. But yeah, this just is... this was not my tempo, I guess, to quote Whiplash.
As you know, I was putting off seeing Wicked, and I think it was because I felt saturated and overwhelmed by all of the trailers. I mean, how many times have we seen the trailers going back 9 months? Really? And I felt like I had already seen the show. Now, again, I did read Gregory Maguire's book. We had tickets to see the original cast in Wicked, but then my mom ended up in the hospital, so we opted to stay with her. So here's one for you, Mama. So I didn't know what to expect, but I was kind of walked into the theater with dread, and I was pleasantly surprised. And so I did not, you know, I'm not one of those people who saw the musical 4 times and can sing all the songs, obviously. But I was just worried that I don't really like this story because, frankly, I like the original Wizard of Oz. And I'm wondering if people still watch it periodically in the same way that we did back in the day when it would come on only once or twice a year.
Yeah, it was always on around Thanksgiving time.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and then around Easter for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess I was a little put off by the whole premise. But having put that aside, I thought the singing and dancing was fabulous. I actually do like a couple of the scenes from In the Heights better. I still think of that swimming pool scene that just was so impressive. So I didn't see anything exactly like that. But, you know, the whole story, I think we kind of know where the second half is going to go because they planted a lot of, quote, Easter eggs for us to...
Well, and you've seen The Wizard of Oz, so
you kind of guess. Yeah, I could kind of
guess. I mean, I know
guess.
It makes... there's some changes there.
Right.
But. And there were two things that I wanted to say. And one was, I thought that the first half was much better than the second half. The second half seemed to drag a bit.
I agree.
I also thought that they made such a big deal of the production of the school itself that when we finally get to Oz itself, it's not that much greater. And that's a mistake, I think, because Oz is what's supposed to be great. And the great thing about the 1939 movie, co-directed by Victor Fleming and King Vidor, was the moment in which you move from a black and white world to the world of color, which in 1939 was amazing. But it even worked well on television in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s when we used to watch it every single year. And the third thing was, I just don't know why they had to make this into 2 complete movies. Why not make it 1, maybe 3-hour-long film, but instead we're going to have 2 movies that add up to probably 5 hours, which is way longer than the stage production would have been.
Yeah.
So I wasn't completely blown away, but I totally agree that the performances by the two women are truly amazing.
Although I have to say I was cracking up a little bit. Michelle Yeoh is always great. And Jeff Goldblum, again, great. But neither of them could sing at all. They were totally doing the Rex Harrison thing.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think maybe they could have cast that a little differently.
I thought Jeff Goldblum was a great choice for The Wizard of Oz because he just has that inherent wackiness about him. Like, there's just something slightly off about everything he does just in...
Okay,
you know,
fair enough.
And I like that about it. I want to go back to the musical numbers in Wicked because I do think they're a mixed bag. And I think a lot of it has to do... we talked about this when we reviewed In the Heights. It has a lot to do with the way that John Chu directs and edits these. He oftentimes directs and edits them like their music videos and not musical numbers, and there's a significant difference there. I think when he goes more small scale, so for a song like Popular, where it's really just the two characters kind of getting ready in their room, I thought that was bright and bubbly and fun, and that worked. When it's one of the big scale numbers, yeah, it often just feels like traffic control. There's so much happening, and it just feels busy and overworked. There are also these moments, like in the Dancing Through Life number, they're inside the school, and there's this mechanism that almost looks like the inside of like a watch, and there are all these dancers inside, and there's obviously this really elaborate choreography.
Did it remind you of Megalopolis?
Lots of things remind me of Megalopolis, but there was clearly all of this elaborate work going on, but he keeps cutting away from it, when I think just a nice, yeah, you know, wide shot of all of this dancing happening could be just as amazing, mm-hmm, as cutting away to try and keep that rhythm going. It just feels, mm-hmm, overworked to me.
And I say this is a cultural phenomenon. I say go see it. Go see it in the Dolby. Have fun. And just don't ask Nathan to be your travel companion.
But if you're going to see Megalopolis, I will go with you. Not that it's playing anywhere, yeah, but really, hypothetically.
Yeah, for good riddance. At any rate, that was our discussion of Wicked, Part 1. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss Juror Number 2. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Subscribe to your favorite public radio programs when you become a Spokane Public Radio sustainer, just like any news or entertainment service you use. But unlike those other services, you decide how much you want to pay. Set up an electronic fund transfer, and monthly installments will be withdrawn automatically from your account. Plus, you can start or stop your subscription at any time you want. As a sustainer, you help make your public radio station strong, and you never have to wonder when to renew. You're part of the community that sustains public radio. Phone 509-328-5729 during business hours, or go online to SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click the red donate button and start the process. Working together, we make our community a better place to work, play, and listen.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed John M. Chu's adaptation of the Broadway musical Wicked. Let's now turn to Clint Eastwood's latest directorial release, Juror No. 2. Justin Kemp, played by Nicholas Holt, seems like an ordinary guy. A writer for a Savannah, Georgia magazine, he and his wife, Allie, Zoe Deutsch, are expecting their first baby, and they both seem happy. The only wrinkle is that Justin has been called for jury duty, and despite his wife's imminent and likely difficult delivery, he can't avoid having to serve. And so begins the latest movie by Clint Eastwood. Based on an original screenplay by Jonathan Abrams, Justin's story gradually turns into an intense mystery involving his past history of alcoholism and the murder trial that he is assigned to that, coincidentally, he may have a direct involvement in. Tautly told, as Eastwood's films tend to be, Juror No. 2 features good performances by Holt and Deutsch, as well as Toni Collette as an ambitious prosecutor, Chris Messina as a zealous defense lawyer, Amy Aquino as an officious judge, and, amid the jury panel, the always reliable J.K. Simmons as a singular voice of reason. The way the film ends might not please everyone, but some of us like stories that leave us with our own possible conclusions as to what's going to happen next.
There are a couple of different ways we could approach talking about this film. One, certainly, Dan, you addressed in your opening, which is looking at the performances by the various characters. The second would be to look at it from sort of through a legal lens and see, you know, is what's happening realistic, et cetera. And finally, I think that we could look at this as what could be the last film of Clint Eastwood's career, although we've said that before and we were wrong. But the guy is 94 years old, just saying. So I was immediately attracted to this film because some of you may remember that Nicholas Holt and Toni Collette were paired previously. She was his mom in About a Boy.
Love that movie. That's a favorite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it was nice to see them together again on the screen, albeit in completely different capacities. And the jury duty aspect of it appealed to me because I remember I was called for jury duty right the week before I was getting married. And so I was trying to navigate that whole thing because I really wanted to be on a jury. And so if we look at this from the performance perspective, I think there were excellent performances across the board. I mean, Chris Messina, I'm always fascinated by him because I always forget who he is. And then he shows up periodically in these films and I think does a good job. I liked Nicholas Hoult's ability to sort of, you know, this dawning of what was happening occurs somewhat gradually. And I like that on his face. The woman who was killed is actually played by Clint Eastwood's real daughter, Francesca Eastwood. And so even those secondary characters, I thought were maybe not well developed, but I thought that all of the actors acquitted themselves wonderfully. Now, from a legal perspective, there's so many things that, you know, you really just have to suspend your disbelief about so many different aspects of this in terms of the way this would have played out, you know, realistically. But Eastwood does pit these different characters against one another because Toni Collette plays Faith, this, you know, hard-charging prosecutor who's up for re-election. And then Nicholas Hoult, you know, he's going to be the 12 angry men sort of character, maybe not wanting to rush to judgment on what happened in this particular circumstance. The one thing, apart from some trial scenes that ignored the rules of evidence, the one thing that concerned me a little bit was in the jury deliberations, everybody seemingly wanted to go home. Let's just go home. And that was really not my experience at various points. Even during voir dire, I think having been on a couple of those panels, people want to do their job. They want to do their best. And it's a hard job. And so I found that to be a little unrealistic, although certainly possible given the circumstances. And then Clint Eastwood, and I'm going to leave this to you both because you are aficionados and occasionally critics of his work. And so, Nathan, direction, what did you think?
Well, I do think that looking at juror number two through the lens of, you know, could this be a last film? Although, as you said, we've said that about about Eastwood's last few movies. But, you know, he has said that this is probably it. But if you look at it through that lens, I think it is an interesting kind of summation of a lot of the themes that have run throughout his work. First of all, it is a movie about change and whether or not people are actually capable of it, of changing their minds about the verdict in a trial, changing their habits or their ways of being, all of those things. And then two, it's about the machinations of a distinctly American institution, which is something that he has long been fascinated by. And in this case, it's the legal system. And it's a movie about how the legal system is ideally supposed to work, but also about all of the flaws and inconsistencies that sometimes keep it from working. And that's basically what this film is about. But it's within the context of this pot boiler of a story, which that's what this is. This is basically like a John Grisham movie that he didn't write. And as the premise began to unfold, as the Nicholas Hoult character starts to realize, oh, I may have actually been involved in this case that I am currently deliberating. And it happens pretty early on, and he has to kind of keep his cool. As it unfolded, I thought, well, this is, it's not absurd, right? Like, you either just think this is silly and discard it, or you go along with it. And I kind of went along with it because this is basically 12 Angry Men. But if Henry Fonda was trying to change everybody's mind because he had a guilty conscience, that's essentially what juror number two is. And I think from that page turner kind of, you know, the breathless quality of the plotting and just that really assured old-fashioned style that Eastwood always brings to his movies, I found it pretty entertaining and involving, even though I was often rolling my eyes at some of the plot developments and some of the characters, because you're right, some of the supporting characters are ridiculously one-note, and they're just there to prove a point. And, you know, again, Eastwood is not subtle about anything he's doing here. Like, Toni Collette will be talking about the justice system, and then she stares longingly at Lady Justice at a statue, and you're like,
yeah, that
okay,
Lady Justice statue came up way too many times.
Almost a supporting character in the film. But yeah, I mostly enjoyed this as, you know, kind of a B-tier prestige film, and I happen to think the ending was fantastic. I really liked the ending of this movie.
I did, too. I just don't think that everybody's going to like
it.
And We talked about it for a while, though.
I totally agree with what both of you are saying. I think that the one thing that is the saving grace for juror number two is the way he films it. And that is, he does it. There are no lags. I mean, the movie just keeps moving, scene after scene, development. You know, I mean, in some of his movies, and I'll point to Gran Torino, there were just some really terrible scenes. And you know, and we just went over the top.
Really great scenes and then some really terrible scenes.
Yeah, exactly.
Too.
But for the most part, juror number two just speeds right along. Yeah. And the second thing is, I can't say enough about Nicholas Hoult. I think he should have been nominated for an Academy Award for Mad Max Fury Road. He was so good in that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got a British accent, and I could not detect one note of a bad American accent.
He's also really good at playing this everyman character, because at the beginning of the movie, his and Zoe Deutsch's lives are almost comically perfect, to where you're like, okay, you're just waiting for something bad to happen, because they can't be this happy for the whole movie, right? And of course, something does. He's really good at playing that everyman who has depths that we don't see right away, because the things we start to learn about his character do make us question, well, could he be capable of this potentially horrible thing that he thinks he might have done?
Yeah.
And I think it's a really convincing performance in a plot that isn't always convincing.
And by the way, we haven't mentioned Kiefer Sutherland is in the role, in a very small role, but a very telling role.
I think kind of wasted a little bit in this movie.
Yeah, I didn't even recognize him for a couple of minutes.
He disappears for a long time.
Well, and I think also in this particular film, I like Eastwood's, you know, mixing it up. We associate him with Westerns, but, you know, he has done some justice system movies before, thinking of Richard Jewell in particular.
Yeah. And Changeling, another courtroom
exactly.
movie.
Yeah. So I do like the fact that he applies his trade in different genres.
Yeah. And that was our discussion of Juror Number Two. Before we close, though, Nathan, didn't you want to say something about the upcoming Bing Crosby Film Festival?
Yeah, I wanted to call out that it's happening, the Bing Crosby Holiday Film Festival. It is at Bing's namesake theater, the Bing Crosby Theater, of course, on Saturday, December 7th. That's this Saturday. And it runs all day. It starts at 11 and it ends at 9. And they're showing White Christmas twice, both at the start of the day and at the end. So you have two chances to see that. But then also Here Comes the Groom and A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. $20 gets you an all-day pass for those. It's free admission for kids 17 years and younger. You can go to BingCrosbyTheater.com and get those tickets. Again, it's this Saturday, December 7th at the Bing Crosby Theater.
Cool. You've been listening to Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Mary Pat Truthart and I discuss the Broadway musical adaptation Wicked and Clint Eastwood's latest film, Juror No. 2. Let's take this moment to thank Cassia Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, where we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late writer Joan Didion. Character, the willingness to accept responsibility for one's own life, is the source from which self-respect springs. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.